Everybody have an outline? Great. I'm a little worried about doing this today because I'm going to talk about some stuff that relates to, like, chemistry. And if we can't figure out how to pass bread and wine around, I mean, I don't know if we're ever going to get this one. We need a map or something. Well, today we're going to talk about dating woolly mammoths and fossils. Not that we're suggesting you do that, but we're going to talk about the dates of these things and when they occurred and all kinds of other stuff like that. This is not the courtship kind of dating. This is radiocarbon dating. This is part two of a series. I did the first one, I guess, back before Christmas. Are we created or self-caused? And I got through, like, the first half of the last outline, which I'm reviewing for you up at the top, and I want to talk more about floods and fossils and stuff like that today. But Genesis 1:1 says that in the beginning God created heaven and the earth. And as creator, he is owner of all that is there, and it should be used according to his purpose and intention. And when we depart from his purpose and intention, things don't work right. Around 1850, a critter came along by the name of Charles Darwin, who had been taught in his theological schools that you really couldn't trust the scriptures. And then he developed a theory to resolve any inner dissonance, and that theory was evolution, which basically says you don't need God. Things just came from nothing, and they're just evolving. And therefore, if you don't need God, there is no God, and you have no accountability to him. Now, there are some Christians who actually believe that's the case, but life works better if you are accountable to an assumed creator. Yeah, that works for them. There are lots of people who believe in a creator but don't have any accountability towards him. And the only way that we can know what actually happened is if the infinite being tells us. And I'm going to review some of the stuff we talked about. Truth is not determined by what you want, but basically by the objective reality, which best explains all the facts. One of the fun things about looking at the subject of evolution is there are bunches and bunches of facts that are just not explained by any current theory. And the more you look, the more you understand that the biblical theory, for lack of a better word, is the one that is most in accord with reality. Scientific proof requires that you observe the thing, you can observe it multiple times, and you can control for all the externalities. And one of the interesting things about creation is you can't prove it scientifically. You can't prove evolution scientifically either. You prove it historically as opposed to scientifically. You can't go back and recreate it multiple times. You have no idea what the exact atmosphere was like way back when. So the idea that things are scientific is a little bit unscientific. The only way a finite number two, finite being, can know infinite truth is if the infinite being reveals it, and that's one of the key thoughts of the scriptures. We also saw that anything that exists has to either be created or eternal. So the universe exists. Was it always existing or was it created? And the last time when we got together and looked at the subject, we saw a whole bunch of reasons for why the universe cannot be eternal. It has to be created. We're probably going to refer to the laws of thermodynamics. The two biggest ones that are observable, are repeatable in a controlled environment, is conservation of matter and energy. Nothing pops into being from nothing, which is the essence of the Big Bang Theory. And entropy. Everything goes from a higher energy state to a lower energy state, which is directly flying in the face of evolution. Number four is a piece that you don't really find in many apologetic books, but it's really the basis for understanding of the accuracy of the scripture. A creator with the power to create this purposeful universe would have the power to communicate to us so that his creation could understand their purpose in that universe. That's what the Bible's all about. Then we looked at some of the complexities of life and forming nucleotides and polypeptides and DNA and all that other stuff. And we kind of saw that things cannot arrive by chance. Guys, what's going on back there? You're kind of being distracting to me. Thanks. Turn around. Thanks. Monkeys can't type. And I had a great quote, which I forgot to bring with me, that said, all molecular biologists have to wrestle with two forms of insanity. And it was an anonymous interview with a molecular biologist. which I gave to Shan because her roommate is a molecular biologist. And it says, insanity number one is you have to be crazy to not see the design of the universe. It's there. As soon as you look, just, you know, peer into your microscope, you see this is incredible. It couldn't have arisen by chance. But insanity number two is you'd have to be insane to admit it, because all federal funding, all educational posts, all that stuff is funded by people who believe maniacally in evolution. So if you admit that there's any intelligent design, as Ben Stein tells us, you get expelled. We also saw that science number six is not scientific, that people are committed to materialism. They design experiments only to get materialistic results. And in the end of a quote by Richard Lewontin, who is the foremost evolutionary biologist in New York Review, he concludes with, materialism is absolute. Our commitment to that materialism is absolute. We cannot allow a divine foot in the door. So science is basically rigged to only come up with materialistic conclusions. When a person doing science comes up with a piece of information that doesn't fit their theory, there is immense pressure to skew the facts because they need to get published, there's worth and value issues, there's feeding your family issues. Not all science is rigged, but a lot of the evolutionary stuff is clearly ignoring facts that don't fit the theory. And that brings us to today, where we want to look at floods and arcs and woolly mammoths and trilobites and octopi and all kinds of other fun stuff. Genesis 7:19, when it's talking about the flood, says all the high hills were covered with the waters. So the high hills were covered with water. And I am told that if you hike up to the top of Mount Everest, something I will never do, I have no desire to do, you'll find marine fossils up there. So how did those little fishies get to the top of Mount Everest? Did they walk up, float up? I mean, they had to float up, but wait, how could you have water at the it just doesn't make sense. In my classes, I ask people, how do you fossilize a jellyfish? We're Jersey people. We've been to the shore. If you go out early in the morning, you can find a jellyfish. If you go out in the afternoon, you never find a jellyfish. Do you know why that is? They dry out, or the gulls get them. Mine. Okay, they disappear. So in order for something to be fossilized, it has to die, stay in one place for years and years, get covered with layer upon layer upon layer upon layer. It just doesn't happen. How could you fossilize a jellyfish? Or one of my favorites, which I spend a lot of time on in my classes, is how can a glacier catch a woolly mammoth? How do you catch one? Well, if they're colored, you can figure out that one pretty easily. How do you catch a blue woolly mammoth? A blue woolly mammoth net. Duh. How do you catch a white woolly mammoth? A white woolly mammoth. You would think so, but no, you take its trunk, you twist it until it turns blue, and then you use your blue woolly mammoth net. Yep, that's how you do it. But how do you catch a plain old brown woolly mammoth? You know, one of these guys. See, is this the one? I don't have a preview of these. Oh yeah, there's a mammoth. And there's the Earth. About 15 years ago, we're living in the village, we got mediocre TV reception, and I saw this little presentation on Noah's Ark, and this is this guy who they called a researcher in the Department of Defense. And he explained something that put together all these huge facts. Now, back in my atheist days when I was in college, I was taking, you know, chemistry and physics and biochem and all this other stuff and philosophy. And I was trying to prove that God didn't exist, but I noticed in my courses that the theories that they were presenting didn't hold water. They didn't make sense. And then when I suddenly saw this little video presentation, which I have referenced for you because it only comes up in a window of 100 by 100, everything made sense. I actually bought something on TV. It's the only thing I've ever bought. And then here, you know, almost a decade and a half later, I was researching some of this stuff, and I came across this information. I said, oh yeah, this is just perfectly sound sense. And I discovered it was Dr. Walter Brown, the same guy who I had on video. He's got a site, he writes a book, he keeps updating it. It's free on his site. He wants you to buy the book. But he has the stuff up there, and it actually could serve as a course for homeschoolers in science. There are actually two or three books that I came across that are online that could be fantastic courses to teach you all kinds of good stuff. But he addressed this question of how you catch a woolly mammoth for real. His premise is what's called the hydroplate theory. And it's a theory because you can't go back and reproduce it, but it accounts for bunches of stuff that you can't account for by anything else. And in his book, he goes through and debunks every other theory. He also had a little bio, which I was immensely edified by. The guy went to West Point. He was a ranger, whatever the higher level trained guys are. He eventually was the first guy in history that the U.S. Army sent to grad school for a PhD. Normally, they always outsource their PhDs, but he was accepted at MIT to do a PhD in physics. He is the youngest instructor at the Army or Air Force, eventually switches over, War College. At 39, he was actually the head of science and stuff like that, and he was asked to head up he headed up a number of science labs for the government, but the geological labs, and he decided to turn that down because he wanted to learn more about geology, so he went back and kind of went to school again to learn more about the stuff, and it's really a fascinating guy, very dedicated, and obviously very intelligent. So he came up with this theory, which makes so much sense to me, that if you look at Genesis, it talks about the world being hammered out in this water above and below, and this crust in the center with a little crack is the thing we walk on. And for the most part, a little sidebar here, that Earth is made of granite. And if you look at it, granite has this little isotope that only has a half-life of 5 minutes, which means that in 5 minutes, this thing disappears. And all the granite all over the world has the stuff in it, which tells you all this granite was formed in less than 5 minutes. Kind of sounds like, boom, it's created. It's not something that evolves out of gases over years and years. This thing had to be granite, was formed instantaneously. A little fascinating thing there. So there's this crust around the Earth. And then you got some grass up there, our friend the woolly mammoth. We should probably call him Willard or something. We'll call him Walter, in honor of Walt Brown. Is standing on. Okay, so this woolly mammoth is going to get in a block of ice. And we got to figure out how this happens. They've uncovered... Someone has estimated 5 million woolly mammoths all around the world in the Arctic Circle, on all the continents, all the way around. Hundreds of thousands of rhinoceri, woolly, you know there were woolly rhinoceri? Yeah, I didn't know that either. not that it makes any difference. But there's a whole bunch of these things. And one of the things that's interesting about these woolly mammoths is they're found not fossilized, but mummified, frozen. And they actually have food in their mouth, food in their teeth. They got a buttercup hanging out of one of the guy's tusks. You know, he's right in the middle of lunch and boom, instantly frozen. How do you do that? How does a glacier catch a woolly mammoth? You know, glaciers move like a foot a year. And even the slowest woolly mammoth would not be able to overcome by a glacier. So how do you do this thing? Because my interest in the food industry, I know a little bit about flash freezing, and they try to flash freeze stuff, and there is no equipment on Earth that can flash freeze a woolly mammoth. You could not make anything big enough, because we have trouble freezing just like a half of a shoulder of beef. But a woolly mammoth has insulation, it's pumping up its heart, it's like, to flash freeze one of these things is, there's nothing that on Earth that we can see that could possibly ever do it. So, how do we get these mammoths caught in a block of ice, perfectly preserved? You can actually, some people actually eat the meat. It's not bad, tastes a little like chicken. No. So let's see if my next one. His contention is that there was a crack in this crust of the Earth. So you have this big plate on top, the water, and then the core down beneath. Okay? And God was up at his computer, and he presses his smite button in the days of Noah, when people were doing their own thing and not doing God's thing. So he got a little ticked at him. And the water starts shooting up out of it. You have a little diagram on your outline from a site that was doing a paper on him. And the heavens break up. There's waters from above and waters from below. These are the waters from below. And once the crack is broached. Or is it breached? Anyway, once you get the crack, the water shoots out, the plate pushes down really, really heavily on it, and the water shoots way, way up in the air. See what happens next. Ah, here, there it is. Okay. And things like there's a crack around the surface of the Earth where there's a mountain range. All the mountain ranges run north to south for the most part, and the Middle Atlantic Ridge is one of these spots. That's where the tallest mountains on Earth are, by the way, in the middle of the Atlantic. Unfortunately, they're underwater. It's not Mount Everest. And this mountain goes popping up. The plates start taking off to the sides, and that's going to, when they eventually bang into each other, because they're going from the direction of this crack, some are going to go up, some are going to go down, and that's how you get hills and valleys. And our water goes up into the atmosphere at supersonic speed, he said. That means like faster than the speed of sound. And when it eventually gets up there, it turns to ice. And then as it immediately comes down, it winds up freezing our woolly mammoth named Walter. He's in the black of ice. And he's stuck. And he's got a great description of this on the site that's referenced in there with other pictures of woolly mammoths. And by and large, all these guys suffocated. They drowned, basically. And there's all kinds of evidence that actually happened. So that's the woolly mammoth story. You can find more about the hydroplates. That's how you catch it. That's also how you'd fossilize a jellyfish. All this stuff immediately coming down is going to instantly catch things. What the non-creationists kind of say is, there were localized floods. I remember seeing something about a fossil find in Arizona or somewhere, and there's a wall about 20, 25 feet high of all kinds of animals, dinosaurs and tigers and bears, oh my, ones from all different periods, stuck together vertically. They didn't just die and, gets covered with sediment. These guys are stuck vertically and just like smushed by, giant wave and fossilized. If ever you've ever had a fish, do you know what happens to fish when they die?
They smell.
They go to fish heaven? Do they sink to the bottom of the tank so sediment can build up on them? They all float and they get eaten. All right, so the fact that these things are alive, well-preserved, is just phenomenal. So this ARC account is pretty decent. Let's see if my next one does that. Oh, yeah. All right, I'm going to look at this little piece of the Earth's crust after the flood. And we have this section, and this is the fossil record. Sometimes it's rock. Sometimes it's muck. When they drill in the permafrost, they go down through muck thousands of feet deep. It's this uniform muck. So I wonder where that came from. Sounds like Noah's flood. When I bring up Noah in my classes, I always get challenged on two things. One is, where did all that water go? And if you flattened out the Earth, the amount of water that we have in the Earth is, if you took the ocean and raised it up and flattened everything out, the Earth would be covered by water 1.7 miles deep. Make sense? And then you basically, as you put the basins in for the oceans, then the water flows into them. We got the water for it. There was a vapor canopy. There's no way the vapor canopy above would have had enough moisture to cover the Earth like that. So you have water from above and water from below. And then it's where do you put all those animals? So there's this guy I gave you. He did a feasibility study on Noah's Ark. That's the actual title. Spent a couple of years exhaustively studying it. And he concluded that the volume of an ark would be equivalent to 522 boxcars. And Noah would have only had to carry 16,000 species. So if you divide that out, basically you could fit 24 of each species, and all the animals could have fit in 67 boxcars. So you got all this extra space, 400 and some odd boxcars for food, for water, for tennis court, whatever else they had on the ark. There's all kinds of things about how they could have been fed, and animals could have been dormant, and you'd have to take full-size animals. There's lots of stuff in Noah's Ark, and that's a whole other story. But if you just do some of the reading on some of these sites, you'll get an education, and it's really kind of fun. So we want to look at some of these fossils, and you notice there's a whale in there. They have found a whale doing a headstand in the middle of the fossil layer through millions of years. So if all these layers were actually millions of years old, this whale would have stood there for millions of years, not getting eaten, and be fossilized. You can find the, there's a picture of it somewhere.
Where was that, do you know?
What?
Do you know where they found it?
No. Where were they? Whales stand on their heads, I don't know. Yeah, it's whale standing on head in whales, I don't know. They got long names there. So one of my archaeological minions put in a little bit of fossils for you. And one of the things you notice is that the there are big fossils at the top, big fossils here. We actually have some big fossils down here and some little fossils up here. Is that on the next slide?
Yeah.
Ah. Well done, Igor. All right. And the layer would expect these little guys on the bottom and then bigger on bigger, and then it works like that. Well, the majority of the fossil record is kind of like that. But the fact of the matter is we get little guys up top and big guys at the bottom. Octopi are found all the way through the fossil record. They are incredibly complex. One of the homeschooling dads, Dr. Cincotta, did his PhD at UCLA, and he got this idea that the eye of the octopus was some sort of grid array, and went and actually discovered that that's what was going on. He said, it's incredibly complex, but you get some at the very bottom of the layer. All through the bottom, you get these little guys called trilobites. And trilobites are these little bites, these little tiny things that have a double lens eye that is so complex that it wasn't until about 60 years ago that we developed the math to be able to describe their lenses of their eyes. But they were like the first life form. So you have a various layers of complexity. And what people do is they'll drill a sample and then throw out all the pieces that don't fit. It's a basic fossil story. Someone said that it's been 150 years since Darwin, and all the fossil evidence that we have that support evolution could fit in a coffin. And most of that is actually suspect. There's no intermediate forms that one thing changed to another. What you have in the whole fossil record, I don't know if I have this. Oh yeah, this is kind of a funny thing. This is Jack Chick does these things called Chick Tracks. And this is one called Big Daddy I saw back in 87. And he says, Lucy, our oldest ancestor is 2.9 million years old. So mankind is almost 3 million years old. But then Christian students said, well, Lacey found a Norman human skull under a layer of rock that was dated at 212 million years old. And most experts now agree that Lucy was only an unusual chimpanzee, not a missing link. So Lucy is bogus. They found some of these things, I'm going to show you the next things, where the teeth had actually been filed by some archaeologist desperate for recognition. One of the guys said, if you spend all your life looking through the ground for shreds of bone, when you find a shred of bone, you desperately want it to be a missing link or a human. And the people have been looking at it and discovering millions and millions and millions of fossils, and none of them support the theory. One more thing on the theory. Let's see, I'll go another slide that you can look at while I do this. Here's these two together, kind of show the progression of man. You know, little guy getting bigger, 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 bigger. In the back of a National Geographic, they actually showed, I can't find this one, we have it somewhere, numerous representations of ancient man that were given to various artists. So they gave some bone fragments, and they said, can you construct a man out of that? And they constructed a huge array of what these things look like. And that's what this stuff is. Most of the bones turn out to be non-human that are now being worked into the scenario. So I'll send this one around, or you can just go into Chick Tracks and look at the Big Daddy track, and you can find all the stuff where they don't exist. And a lot of them have been shown to be forgeries. So there's Heidelberg Man, and there's Nebraska Man, and there's Putdown Man, Peking Man. Supposedly there's this guy called Peking Man that was found near Beijing, and no one has ever seen the bones. They disappeared. Okay, so no one can examine these things. Then they actually have a videotape of one of the Asian scientists going out and planting things. And then the whole thing fell apart. It's a hoax. Well, you go into Wikipedia, it's still presented as the absolute truth. Maybe some creationists disagree with this, and that's it. But if you look at some of these references I have in there, you'll show. They'll show all the evidence. They'll show the guys admitting that they're frauds and hoaxes. And it's all kind of bogus. So a lot of pigs and chimpanzees are through this thing. Neanderthal man, Guinea man, Magnon man. Basically looks just like a human. So these things are all bogus. If you just research them, you'll find out that, hey, it doesn't really exist. So he says, all these layers of the earth are millions of different years, difference in age. We can tell the age of these layers by the fossils contained in them. Well, how do we find out the age of the fossils? Oh, by the layer that they're in. So they're dating both of them by their theory, and they're using one to validate the other. So, yes, that is circular reasoning. Oh, there's the arc thing. I came across something, I think it was in Walt Brown's stuff, that I remember from my high school biology book. Last week I told you about the little flask getting bombarded, and you know, then the light that was peptides jumped together, and the very next instant they would have fallen apart. Well, it deals with the moths on trees, and most of you have this in your textbooks, where off the shore of England they have a little island, and there are light moths and dark moths, and at one point before the industrial age, there were predominantly light-colored moths on the island. And then when the smog came, the populations, the trees turned black, and then there were predominantly black moths on the island. And they say this is proof of evolution because they changed from being white moths to black moths. Well, no, it isn't proof of evolution. It looks like evidence for what's called natural selection, which I, as a Christian, would be totally comfortable with. The white moths got eaten when the trees turned dark, and the black ones just reproduced because there's more food supply. Yeah, that's perfectly fine. But then the story comes out that the photographer who photographed this stuff said, well, we had this little problem because we couldn't find any moths on the trees. See, what happens is they sleep under leaves during the day when the birds can see them, and they only come out at night. So we actually had to capture the moths and glue them onto the tree. They're admitting this. This is true, and the science books are still producing it. You know, maybe it's finally gotten out of some of them. But natural selection is valid, but even this scientific evidence is rigged. Okay, so we talked about the arc. Oh yeah, so you might notice that I've got something on your paper called upside down. These are fun things. They're called overthrusts. Big hunks of land that the stuff at the top is a lot older than the stuff at the bottom. Somehow they flipped around. And when we went to Yellowstone, remember, years ago, we headed north to go to the Canadian Rockies, and we passed through this beautiful spot called Glacier National Park. It is absolutely gorgeous. And they've got these really old tour buses that you can take on, and we hiked up. The Alpine Meadows exist there, and it was just, our family was just reminiscing a couple weeks ago, Christmas, how much fun that place was. Well, there's this Glacier National Park is largely composed of an overthrust, where this huge piece of land is a flip upside down. It's called the Lewis Overthrust, I believe. And this thing is big. It's 135 miles by 15 miles by 3 miles deep. That's at basically the size of Long Island. It's twice the size of Rhode Island. I was thinking, I wonder how this compares to Rhode Island. Did you have any idea Rhode Island was so tiny? Yeah, it's just like, that's why they don't have any toll booths there. They have no place to put them. All right. But you have this huge piece of land that's been flipped upside down, and the stuff that it's resting on is shale, undisturbed shale. So how did this thing flip? And people have talked about, if there was some cataclysmic event, there's no record of it, but the thing would have broken as a flip. There had to be some flood for this thing to have flipped over. And there are a whole bunch of these things. One of my favorites is the Matterhorn. Yeah, big mountain. But they've actually concluded it came from a spot, 20, 30, or 60 miles away. So one night, the Matterhorn decided to up and move, and it tiptoed across all these other mountains without damaging none of them, and then wound up plop in its current position. So what most evolutionists will kind of say is, oh, well, there were localized floods that caused all these things, because they don't want to admit to a global flood, because all the evidence from the Bible points there. All the evidence points there, but they don't want to agree with whatever the Bible has to say. Petrified trees are just like our whale. They go through multiple layers. If you do even a modicum of research on this stuff, you'll realize that there are hundreds of examples of stuff that just doesn't fit the theory, which is going to bring us up in a minute to carbon dating. But first, on your sheet, where's proof of evolution? there isn't any. People disprove them. This is more of the Big Daddy thing. Okay, we're going to start talking about this in a minute, but I want to talk a little bit about our friend the moon and the sun. Our moon has been visited by us. Our moon is a real problem for, quote, scientists, because there's no way our moon could have become our moon. It doesn't make sense. Here's why. Our Earth is one substance, our moon is another substance. So they're two different things. The moon could not have come from the Earth. And then you have the question of how did it get out there? So the theory is it was some traveling, you know, meteor, wandering planet, you know, maybe it's Pluto's brother. It comes over and it would get pulled into the Earth's gravitational field and then somehow suddenly decide to stop and hang out there, which is totally impossible. It would keep going until it crashed. Speaking of such things, without the moon, life on our planet would not exist. We need the tides. The tides stir up all the little thingies in the ocean, and you know, they make oxygen, and we live happily ever after. But did you know that our moon is taking a hike? It is moving away from us at this startling rate of, I think, I should have it. Yeah, 1.5 inches a year. It's running away. It's doing it slowly. I'm leaving. And if you do a little calculation, you try to move it back 2,000 years, it would have fallen into the Earth's atmosphere. Because once you get so close, like what the guy's name is, probably one of our rocket scientists knows this, but once it gets close enough, then it gets sucked in and goes bang into Earth. And if you tried to make the Earth really, really old, the moon would have actually started out as Earth and somehow managed to break through this phenomenal gravitational field to get out to where it is. It's this huge gravitational force, which causes the tides. And there's no way the moon could have actually done that. But now it's far enough out, it keeps drifting. On the numbers there, there are two moon rocks that came back. They were found next to each other. One was dated at 2 million years old, and one right next to it was dated at 28 billion years old. If you go and search any of the normal stuff on dated moon rocks, the moon rocks conclusively prove that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, just like our theory predicts. But wait, what about these two rocks? They just ignore the pieces that don't fit the data. Obviously, neither of them fit the 4.5 billion years old scheme. The amount of moon dust, there's like 3 inches of moon dust. They were expecting 182 feet or up to 20 miles of moon dust. And it's just like inches of dust on there. If it was infinitely old, you'd have all this dust accumulated. And the first lunar lander had all these feet and everything to keep it from sinking into all the dust. And guess what, folks? There's no dust. Our friend the sun is shrinking. Well, it's burning up, actually. You know, eventually it burns up. And it burns up at about 1.5 kilometers a year. So if you back it up, that rate at which our sun is getting consumed, and when it was bigger, it was probably burning a little faster rate. You back it up just 1 million years, it'd be so close to the Earth that it would have boiled us. We'd be crispy critters. And if you back it up 210 million years, the sun is actually on Earth. Actually, Earth is now dust in the sun. It couldn't be that old. You can find some of these items on any of these links. By the way, after the hydroplate theory, right under number 7, that last link is actually a 10-minute video by Dr. Brown that was in the NOAA Arc video that some of you have seen. You can find that on your own. Okay, now we get to carbon dating. Now, this is going to get a little bit scientific. It's not going to be that painful. In college, I took organic chemistry and then inorganic chemistry and biochemistry, and I can't remember any of the stuff. So I had to go back and look at this thing and say, okay, well, how do these things actually work again? So there's this stuff called carbon 12, that kind of one of the basic building blocks of life. And the most common substance in our Earth's atmosphere is the stuff called nitrogen. It's a gas. Right, it's like 80% of the atmosphere is nitrogen. And as this nitrogen moves through the Earth's atmosphere, it gets bombarded with cosmic radiation and becomes carbon-14. 14. It's a radioactive form. Okay, that's all you need to know. I'm going to give you more than you want to know right here. But you can go all take a nap. You guys back row, you don't have to pay any attention to this until you have to, your chemistry book. But this is our friend the atom. And the things that are rotating around the outside are electrons. And in a millionth of a second, they spin around this nucleus millions of times. It's like, how do they do that? And in the center, you've got this thing called a nucleus that's composed of two things. Protons that are positive and neutrons that are neutral. Now, one of the big questions of life is, I thought charges that are alike repel. You've all done a little magnet and you put the right ends next to each other and they move away. So how do you get a bunch of protons holding together? Shouldn't they just explode? I think there's a verse in Colossians that Jesus Christ holds all things together, something like that. But this is one of those. There's something now called a gluon, which is imaginary, it's made up. Yeah, there's a gluon that glues them together. Great, okay. What's a gluon? Well, it's a thing that holds them together. Have you ever seen one? No, but it must be there. Why? Because it holds them together. But we've never seen this thing, it doesn't exist. Right, but it has to be there. Sure, it makes sense to me. So this is our basic carbon thing. And if it was a nitrogen thing, it would have an extra proton and an extra electron. Those guys always have to balance out. And the neutrons. See, do I have this next one on the slide? Okay, on the far left is carbon 12. That's nice and stable. And then one part to a trillion is this little guy on the right, which is carbon 14. That's the thing to use for dating. And if you actually look at this a little more closely, Answers in Genesis, that's where I stole this from, has the all the text that kind of goes with it. But you'll notice that the little guys in the center, it's missing one. Yeah, they match up. On your, see if the next one does it. Okay. I'll get to that in a second. Look on your sheet under carbon dating. By and large, carbon 14 goes down to nothing in 50,000 years. So you cannot date anything by carbon dating over 50,000 years old. Just goes, phew, you know, it's gone. Keeps getting half life. Every 5,370 years, it gets less and less. It cuts in half. So, Mount St. Helens. Let me tell you about this first. Somebody went up to Mount St. Helens, which exploded, what, in the 80s? And they got samples of the rocks. They ground them up. They sent them off to the two most prestigious labs in the United States. I think both of them are located in Cambridge. And they got dates back of, like, you know, 275 million years old to a billion years old. But we know that the thing just exploded. But so the carbon dating wasn't exactly accurate. There was a Hawaiian volcano that erupted in 1801. Same thing. Millions and billions of years old for this thing that was dated, what we know. And people said, oh, well, you got samples from the crust, you know, as opposed to from the lava. But basically what happens is this carbon-14, actually it's an argon one. These things decay at different rates. I'll get there. Let's look at how this carbon-14 is formed. On that top line under carbon dating on your outline, at the end, I've got carbon-12. That means it's atomic weight or atomic number? Are they the same thing? Okay, atomic weight or atomic number is 12. And it normally has a little subscript 6 underneath it, which means the number of protons. And then you do a little math, subtract 6 from 12, and you get the number of neutrons. So for any chemical element that's got that little number up there, that's the total weight of the protons and neutrons. And the proton number is listed, and that's got to equal the number of electrons. All right, so next line under formation. This N1 is some sort of radiation. It comes in, and it takes the nitrogen and knocks it into carbon 14. So what it really did is it took one of the protons and moved it over to become a neutron. That way the carbon has 6 protons and 8 neutrons. Now that carbon wants to go back to behaving itself as carbon 12. It wants to get rid of this extra stuff that the radiation caused it to have. So it goes through what's called beta decay. And this is what we call radiation. So the carbon-14 goes back to nitrogen, and it gives off the proton. And when the proton goes off, you get a neutron and a little bit of radiation, a positron, and you know, you can check this out, and just research beta decay. I'll tell you what happened. So that's the radiation. So the number, amount of carbon 14 in something is going to start decaying once the animal dies. Because what happens is, during life, the carbon 14 in the air becomes carbon dioxide, and the plants eat that. We eat the plants. And during our life, we're going to have about the same amount of carbon 14 in us as the atmosphere. When we die, we stop eating. I think that's what happens. What a shame. And then that carbon is going to decay back into nitrogen. So they'll dig up a sample of something, they'll measure the ratio of the two different carbons to each other, and they'll say, oh, it's this old based on this decay rate. Lots of problems with this, but that's how they do it. So when the thing dies, it's no longer gaining, so then it starts losing it, and the total carbon decreases over time, and within 50,000 years, there's nothing. That means you cannot carbon date anything over 50,000 years. Now, rocks are dated with potassium, argon. It's a similar process. They all have the same flaws, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. Okay, this is the decay rate, 50,000 year max. So for someone to say something is carbon dated at over 50,000 years, it's like, can't be. It doesn't exist. So they have a starting amount, the current amount, and then they figure we know what it decays at, and we can calculate the age. The problem is we really don't know the starting amount. Is that the end? Great. Okay. So, in Australia, this is under the formation line, some wood was clearly buried in lava that had formed basalt, as was seen from the charming. So this stick was near a volcano, and the lava flowed around it and burnt up the stick a bit. They unearth it, and lo and behold, we have a stick in lava. That's pretty simple. So now we're going to date them. Let's figure out how old these things really are. And the stick was dated by carbon 14 analysis, which we just described, and it was 45,000 years old. But the basalt, the lava flow, was dated to be 45 million years old. So how does a 45,000 year old stick wind up encased by this stuff that clearly is older than the stick, that's 45 million years old? When you start seeing this repeatedly, you begin to realize the theory is bogus. Every time someone comes up with data that doesn't fit the theory, they throw out the data. Walter Brown does a really interesting story. He basically figured out how the Grand Canyon was formed, and it's kind of an interesting story. He actually goes a couple days before his daughter's wedding and gets trapped there, but his ranger training got him out. And one of the things that you can go through the Grand Canyon is, okay, there's no problem of where we took the lava samples from, but at the top of the Grand Canyon, they dated the stuff, and then they dated the rocks at the bottom, and which would you expect to be older? The stuff at the bottom. But the rocks at the top are 270 million years older than the rocks at the bottom. Something's not right in Arizona. You can find hundreds of these examples. Blood of a seal, freshly killed, was tested by carbon 14 and basically said it's been dead for 1,300 years. Living mollusks, you know, clams, have been, you know, mussels, shellfish, you know, dated millions of years old, and they're still living. The hair on one of our mammals was found to have a carbon age of 26,000 years, but the peaty soil around it, which was basically had trapped it, was 5,600 years old. That means this mammoth died, stood there for 20,000 years. Nobody ate him, and he didn't decay, and then the peat filled in around him. Makes perfect sense to me. All right, and you'll just, these things just multiply. Okay.
So what's going on, like, when they find a piece of pottery and then they say, oh, well, this must have come from a civilization 10,000 BC? What are they testing? How are they coming up with that?
They're using carbon dating on some of the stuff. And they also are dating it by the layer that it's found in. Oh, here's another thing. They go into coal mines and they extract, you know, coal was formed, according to the evolutionary theory, billions of years ago. And they discover human artifacts, like, you know, pots and arrows and knives, in the coal. And they say, how can that get there? Oh, someone must have planted it there. because it doesn't fit the theory. Our understanding of this theory as to how coal and gas deposits gets formed is when these plates started moving, the earth before the flood was extremely lush because it had this vapor canopy all around it, and as the plates moved and they wrinkled, they basically encompassed large masses of vegetation under massive pressure. And they've been able to produce coal in a lab in, you know, I forget how long it takes, weeks or less than a year, as opposed to billions and billions of years to produce this coal. So they're finding artifacts in coal, which obviously you can't have humans before coal. You're just like they have human tracks and dinosaur tracks, the same thing. You have a human footprint that actually stepped on a prehistoric little buggy thing that could not possibly exist, but he's stuck to the bottom of the guy's heel, you know, in the mud, and he gets fossilized. So when they find these artifacts, they'll date them by the carbon dating, but a major, major, major problem with carbon dating is that it has unproven and disproven assumptions. For instance, they are assuming they know the starting conditions, that there was no daughter isotope present at start, like there was no C14 to start, or we know how much there was. That's unproven. We don't know that. And then we say the disproven stuff is the decay rates have always been constant. We've shown differing decay rates in the research. And the systems were closed or isolated, so no parent or daughter isotopes were lost or added. Those are three unproven things about all forms of the dating. The last two are disproven. They've shown, I mean, we're just showing now how the amount of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere changes. When volcanoes happen, things at the beginning of the flow have one date, things at the end of the flow have another, because it changes. It's a theory that is totally bogus. I believe, I didn't get a chance to verify this for you, but if you go into online Bible, they have this thing called the quote book, and I think it's over 50,000 quotes from scientists that say this whole dating stuff is bogus. Only 150 of them have acknowledged any kind of faith basis. So there are, you know, 49,000, whatever the math is, 850 scientists that don't believe in God, don't believe in the Bible, and don't believe in any of the dating methods. It's all unproven or disproven. So when they date this little fossil, or this, you know, pottery that they have, they're using a method, you know, it depends on how close the thing was to the fire, how much carbon it got in it. It's like what the atmosphere was like. Things change so much. Okay, the net of all this is that the theories are theories that are bad and unproven when you're talking about evolution. When you're talking about creation, there's a lot of reality behind it. And it kind of makes sense that God would have done things, held them together. And the piece that applies to us in particular is, as I think about things like if the distance of the moon to the sun was, or the earth to the sun, and the solar system was just, and the magnetic fields were just out of kilter a tiny little bit, life as we know it would just, boom, fall apart. So God has very specific tolerances for the temperature on earth, how we can live, all these other things. And the implication is, if he has such great plan, purpose, and specification for these little things, he's got a plan, a purpose, and a specification for us. And actually, that's how I became a believer. I was taking a neurobiology course, and I was also minoring in philosophy to prove God didn't exist. And I'm sitting out in a gorge, and I'm looking around, there's this little spot up in Ithaca, and Treman State Park, and I'm looking out at it, and I'm looking at the order and, you know, complexity of the world around me, and I kind of knew what I was learning in my classes about the incredible order and complexity within me, and then I thought about the thing that's between me. There's got to be a purpose for me. Everything around me's got purpose, everything within me's got purpose. What about me? And I didn't know my purpose because I was alienated from the source of the purpose, which is God. And then eventually, you know, the revelation led me to him. But then it continues. He continues to have purposes for us. All things work together for good for those who love God and are called according to his purpose. Okay, questions that I won't be able to answer. Yeah, hands.
Just a comment. There's a man by the name of Emmanuel Velikovsky. Velikovsky was an incredible Russian scientist who wrote a number of books, the most famous of which, Worlds in Collision, Ages in Chaos, couple of others. He was totally out of favor with all the scientists. When I was in Princeton, in fact, I almost got thrown out of my professor's office for going to go in and talk about it. But he he also postulates, because he found that the saber-toothed tigers caught these ice floes with food in their mouth. He said it just couldn't possibly be. The evolutionists had to be wrong. His theory, ice, is that there was several places in history where it suggests that Venus may have come close to the mm-hmm. Earth. Venus has a tail of ice, and this ice swept across the Earth and froze many of these things in space. That's why you find tropics in the Antarctic. If you dig into the Antarctic, you'll find that at one point there was tropics and vice versa. You had some polar shifts and other things. If anyone is interested, I urge you to get a hold of his books. There's been a society that was formed after his death, and they have traced some of the predictions that he made and found that he's been incredibly accurate, contrary to what all the scientists wanted you to know. He was not a believer, but he was on the verge of it. My father met with him in Princeton for a while for other reasons related to weaponry that he was involved in. But a very interesting man, was on the verge of belief at the time he died, because he saw that all of the theories of evolution just didn't hang together. And it's incredible reading. Start with Worlds in Collision, even though that wasn't the first one.
Yeah, the feet of the woolly mammoth has a hair on it, and they're tropical creatures. In their system, they found tropical parasites. Animals that live in the Arctic have fur, so the snow doesn't catch it. A woolly mammoth, if it had hair, wouldn't be able to walk, because it would continually mat with more and more snow, and that would be part of the process. The Velikov, his theory doesn't fit how we got Walter Brown's theory. I like better, because it fits all the other pieces, but it is interesting.
He was the missing link between there and here, and I think has many reasons to read.
Mm. Yes?
Okay, I'm just going to ask it.
Sure.
Well, it's supposed to be a question. But let's go back to the ice coming up and catching these woolly mammoths. Then, this is during the flood, right? So, are there like ice cubes floating around? Or is it water, wouldn't the water like melt? Do you know what I mean? Or has this, the water super cold, so it then when everything like dries out, it's left as an ice cube. I don't understand.
Okay, you have this flood has different stages. So there's waters coming down from above. That causes havoc, creates one layer of stuff. And by the way, if you ever go to the beach, if we go down, we're going down to Ocean Grove for, if you get out there, you see the tide goes out, you'll look at where the sand forms, and there's all kinds of studies that have been done, which show that when moving water settles, things settle in layers. So that explains all these layers. But there are some layers that are caused by the initial water coming down. There are others that are caused by the ice coming down. So it's actually coming down as just boom, not ice cubes, just total ice, boom. Then there's additional water that continues to come down. So you have multiple things going on. Obviously, can't recreate everything. But if you look at the pieces and you start building the model, you can basically... You should be able to, I'm sure someone's done this, come up with different stages as to what would happen at what point. Yeah, Lee.
So I was building a fire this past week, and I noticed that the fire burns faster towards the beginning of it, and it kind of slows down when there's less to burn. So is there any way that the shrinkage rate of the sun was actually higher? Therefore,
yep.
It may not have come closer.
That would make sense that it would have been higher. Initially, because it burns when it's bigger. Even if it's just bigger, it's going to burn more. So there are some people that are concerned about our sun burning out and becoming extinct. These are people who worry about the Earth ending and so many millions of years down the road. So therefore, we must explore Mars. Makes sense to me.
So therefore, yeah. The distance a long time ago wouldn't have necessarily been as close as predicted if you measured at the rate that it's burning now.
Correct. So an inch a year now, or whatever you said.
Like 1.5 kilometers.
1.5 kilometers. Higher, and therefore we can say that the sun is older?
Right. That I don't know. Basically, you're looking at a creation 4,000 years ago. You're looking at the flood 3,000 years before Christ.
Wait,
4,000 BC.
I'm just saying, so therefore it could be more, right?
It could have been, yeah. Right. It could definitely have been different. History doesn't start until 3000 BC, 3200 BC. So it just accords really well with the biblical account. Tito, you had a question earlier?
Yeah, There's one thing that has been perplexing Hubble up in space shuttle astronauts when it's time to go out of the Earth's atmosphere. The law of thermodynamics, the second law of thermodynamics usually says that as during the burning process, as you move farther out, the energy dissipates. That means the temperature has to come down until towards the last strata it becomes really cold. But in the study in system optics of orbital systems, the astronauts have found out that through the telescopes and decay mechanism, they found that as you go outer the Earth, instead of getting colder, it gets hotter. And they have been noticing more what they call black holes, which could have been the origin of the universe. The farther you go out to the Earth, the more black holes are seen, and the more energy is seen. That cannot be explained by the second law of thermodynamics, which says that as you go farther away from a burning process, the product should be colder. But there's one thing that in Isaiah that says that the, when God stretches out the heavens, and like it's a canopy there. So they say that in a sense, the energy that instead of getting lower is getting higher, is that the universe is constantly expanding. Now, one thing also that has fascinated me all this time, you know, when you want to know who a singer sang a song, you have clues by their beats, by their musical tone. I'm very fascinated by the concept of the nucleus and protons, electrons moving around it. It's like our solar system in a huge dynamic scenario with the sun in the middle.
Great.
And the
yeah, I think there is definitely a correlation between
that. The atoms and a person who could have thought of holding the system in equilibrium. Like, for example, you have the nucleus being bombarded and electrons, protons, and going around. It's like in a trillion times magnified in our solar system. Like, it's inside the sun and around it by the planets. And this is also perplexed scientists because they cannot explain why such similarity exists.
Right. Our explanation would be really simple. It comes from the same creator. There's a pattern that's reflected. One of the things that's interesting is the further out you get, which goes, in one sense, almost against our observable law of second law of thermodynamics, is the universe is actually expanding at a faster rate, which doesn't make sense. So what science does is they postulate black holes. I went to a lecture by an astrophysicist who said, we've never really seen any black holes, we just propose that they're there. So they have to put more and more black holes in to try to calculate the theory. And now they've come up with these things called antimatter and dark energy. It's like imaginary stuff. Someone said, I can't remember, it's only 30% of the mass of the universe is actually observable. Based on our theories would account for this amount of, what? It's only 10%? Yeah, it's a really small, like, where's the rest of it? Oh, parallel universe. Sliders is correct. All right. Well, I smell pizza, which basically means that, you know, it's clearly the will of God that we stop and eat. All right, so let's pray. Thank you, Father, that you are reliable and trustworthy in everything. Thank you that you superintend and care for things that we don't even know. Thank you that you show the same care for our lives. And I pray that we'd respond acknowledging your wisdom and guidance over each of us. Thank you that we live in a world that you take care of. Thank you that we have nothing to fear from silly theories of silly people. And thank you that we can explore our world and discover more of your order and pattern. I pray for us as we interact with people who might believe otherwise that you would help us come to a mutual understanding of truth, which best explains all the facts. We thank you for our food. We thank you for the fellowship that we can enjoy. Thank you for Jesus. In his name we pray. Amen.
All right, quick announcement. Toyo has been a great help to a lot of us, and we're zeroing in on a Toyo date.